Hello and welcome to AIPT Comics Podcast, the number one comics podcast on AIPTComics.com. You don't even know how many people ask me all the time, hey, but are there other comic podcasts on AIPTComics.com? And I always say, no, there isn't. That's the joke. My name is David Brook, and I'm here with Forrest Hollingsworth.
Hello, that is Forrest with two R's, and this week I'm excited to talk about comics.
I should hope so, because we've got a tall glass of comics for you coming up. Later in the show, we have Zach Thompson and Lonnie Nadler to talk about Undone by Blood, or The Shadow of a Wanted Man, a new Aftershock comic series coming out February 12th. I can't wait to read this. Wait, I already did. I can't wait for you to read this.
Yeah.
And I can't wait for you to hear this interview. It's a good one, folks. Hang in for that.
And folks are going to say, didn't you guys have Lonnie on like 2 weeks ago for an interview about Black Stars Above? And we're going to say, yes, it was a good interview and he was very kind. And also they have more projects coming out because those guys are workhorses in the industry and we want to promote indie creators. So put that in your comic milkshake and drink it up.
So don't tell Lonnie this, but we're actually doing a slow build up for him to be one of the co-hosts on the show. We just need to have him be on maybe 20 or 30 more times this year and we'll make it happen.
Right.
So on this show, we review our favorite comics out last week. We talk about the week ahead. And first, we talk about the news, the top news of the week, the latest and greatest, the stuff everybody's talking about. And at the top of our list is a brand new publisher called Bad Idea.
I was going to say, on top of our list is a bad idea.
Well, we'll see. They haven't come out with any books yet, but they have a fascinating new way of selling comic books. They came out with a press release explaining more or less the entire idea behind Bad Idea. And they're calling themselves unruly and experimental, but also prestigious. They're selling single-issue comics to a select 20 comic book shops. I'm sorry if I'm laughing, because it's a bit preposterous, but at the same time, crazy that they're even trying this. So anyway, single-issue comics, $3.99. They're not extra expensive, but they're only being sold to 20 different comic stores. And supposedly, the comic shop will only allow one per person of any of their books. There are going to be no trades, no hardcovers, no bookshelf formats, only single issues. And they also revealed that they have a pretty cool lineup of creators, starting with Matt Kint and Doug Braithwaite. We've also got Marguerite Bennett, Joshua Desart, Thomas Scarella, Eric Heiserer, who's done some fantastic work at Valley Entertainment, Jody Hauser, Jeff Lemire, Peter Milligan, Robert Venditti, Zeb Wells. It goes on and on. These are some big, big names. So, Forrest, start me off here. What do you think of this model that they're offering?
So I think that the other piece of information to contextualize what I'm about to say is that Bad Idea was the brainchild of a bunch of former Valiant employees, editors, right, and other higher-ups and stuff. And it makes me think, these are people that know the comics industry, right?
Sure.
Matt Kent puts out dozens of books a year. Valiant, as high level as an editor, you can't edit comics without understanding pacing, the direct market, consumer and creator expectations and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes me think that they are using that information to be somewhat manipulative.
Interesting.
Because this is just not the way comics are published.
Right.
And yeah, sure, like that's the same as can be said for The Walking Dead surprise ending. That's just not the way you do stuff, and it'll get everyone to talk about it and stuff. But they did a second printing of The Walking Dead ending right away.
Mm-hmm.
My thing is, and I saw Christopher Sabella saying this as well, and it was a thought I had almost immediately. If you're not trying to get your comics in as many stores as possible,
mm-hmm,
and you're not trying to get them to as many consumers as possible, you are selling something else.
Yes, right.
And I'm not sure what it is.
Mm-hmm.
My inclination would be TV and movie deals.
Right. And I mean, you're probably trying to create a conversation where people want something, right? We see this with other industries like, right, sneakers, where they only put out a certain, like my Thanos Marvel sneakers.
Yeezys. Yep. Yep.
There's only a certain amount. You have to get there and buy them on the day of, or it's gone forever. They haven't talked about reprintings. So that's maybe possibly in a possibility. But for a market that is majorly, you're getting a profit from graphic novels and the collected editions of comics.
Right, yeah. Most readers are collective edition readers.
To come out right up front and say we're not doing that
right.
is fucking bold. I was shocked, actually, when I read this.
I mean, I genuinely feel like it is a bad idea. I don't necessarily understand what the angle is. It's very hard for me to believe that this is a good deal for creators.
Yeah.
Because you're not getting as much money based on that model. I really don't understand. Maybe they just raised a ton of capital to do this experimental art project or whatever.
Yeah.
And that's fine. I think that we should push forward in the industry in terms of creator input, in terms of publishing, in terms of how publishers interact with consumers, all that stuff. We talk about problems in the industry every week.
Yeah.
But I don't think doubling down on all the problems the industry has is the right way to address those problems, I guess.
Yeah, you bring up a good point. Like, how are the creators going to make any money off this?
Right. I have no idea.
One thing that one of our, you know, coworkers at AIPT pointed out, Connor Christensen pointed out, the eBay market is going to be insane. If yeah, there are only 20 comic shops, people are going to be taking their issue, even if I highly doubt, honestly, a comic shop's only going to give a person one issue. But if they did, that person could flip that comic for if there is a market for it,
yeah.
for double, triple, maybe $50 an issue.
Yeah, $50 an issue easily. I mean, Walking Dead, the finale of Walking Dead was selling for like $550 the day it was revealed that happened. So I don't know.
The immoral part of me wonders, now this is not true at all, and this is just me, you know, shooting shit here, but what if Bad Idea started selling issues on eBay?
Sure.
But not as themselves, as like a secret person.
I mean, it's such a weird clandestine thing that they're doing.
Right.
That I don't know that they recognize that kind of negative thinking is where you have to go immediately.
To make it have it make sense.
Right. Like they have to be doing something. I'm flabbergasted by it. I know that in rural America where I live, I mean, seriously, the town that I live in goes 3 minutes in each direction.
Right.
These comics aren't going to be at my LCS.
Right. You have to imagine it's going to be like Midtown in New York.
Right. The other extreme is that TKO is also not at my LCS.
Right.
And they're the other extreme. We're doing all this prestige printing. We're putting out all our books at once. I'm more inclined to enjoy that model. I like the work they've done on the technical side. I don't know. It reminds me of, do you remember that movie that John Malkovich made that no one will ever see? 100 Years is an upcoming, in quotes, science fiction film written by John Malkovich and directed by Robert Rodriguez. The 2015 tagline for the movie was, "The movie you will never see, and it is due to be released on November 18th, 2115.
Right.
And this is what that reminds me of.
Here's the problem, though. It's harder to rip off a movie and put it on the internet. You know how this is we've been talking about this for months, if not the entirety of this show. Piracy is a huge problem in comics.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
If it's this rare, it's going to be on the internet within seconds. And I know it's not going to be on Comixology. They already said it's not going to be digitally available, but someone can easily take a picture of every page within 2 minutes and post it online. And then what do they do?
I have no idea. And I have no idea if that's the intention.
Yeah.
The thing that gets me, I mean, I could honestly talk about this for the entire episode length, and I'm trying not to. But the other thing that gets me is like, so what's the value proposition for a creator? Are they going to fucking Matt Kent and saying, "Hey, dude, put your best idea into this book that no one is going to see"?
They must have some different pricing model. They must like hand them like $2,000 up front, right?
They
some
have
cash.
To. They have to have some sort of something working like that. I think art can be intrinsically and inherently interesting when it is created only for the artist.
Right.
That's not a problem that I have, especially like I like experimental film and all sorts of weird shit.
Mm-hmm.
I like David Lynch's opaque, imperceptible, weird stuff of him interrogating a monkey for 12 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, and that was clearly made for his own kicks. And that's fine. You can do the same with comics, but I feel like David Lynch is in the financial position to be able to
take those risks.
And I don't know. Everything that I know about the industry would imply to me that creators are not in don't have that same kind of financial security.
Some of these creators that they've announced, probably they have so many books out, they're probably doing okay, but not all of them.
Right.
So
right.
How do they pull this off? Yeah, it's a really interesting question. I think this is one of the reasons why I'm so fascinated by it, because maybe it is just, you know, they're just doing this to create waves and stir up the pot, but actually not make money up front. I don't know. They did say in the press release, it will be available in 50 comic stores by the end of the year. So I guess the idea is to slowly continue to launch. But I mean,
I guess
50 comic shops is still not that many comic shops. I mean, I don't even know how many comic shops are in America. Probably a thousand.
Thousands, I bet. Yeah. Thousands, I would say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm very curious to see.
I mean, we'll keep a beat on it for sure. Goes. But yeah. I definitely, my gut check is this is bad.
There's no way they're going to send
manipulative, and I don't know how.
Yeah.
And it makes me worried. It's not my position to be like, oh, we got to look out for creators. They make their own decisions or whatever. But it does make me feel a little protective of them.
I wonder if they're going to send review copies out. Probably not, right?
No. No way.
Definitely not digitally, but maybe physically.
Maybe on a giant stone tablet.
If it's so hard to find, what's the use of a review anyway?
Right.
In our next bit of news, Cullen Bunn authors a lengthy Twitter thread about being accused of hiring ghostwriters. He found out via his editor. This is upsetting news and sad, too.
Yeah. I was upset by this. Cullen Bunn, obviously the official comics writer of the AAPT Comics podcast. It's kind of an in-joke for the people that have been listening since the single-digit episodes. But Cullen tweeted out, so an editor called me last night to tell me that someone is telling other editors and publishers that I use ghostwriters. This infuriates me for so many reasons, that the least of which is that it is 1,000% untrue. It went so far as they named some of my books and said I was the writer on that.
That's crazy.
And then his thread goes on. He's got some details like, it is true that I write fast, but it's actually because I have a lot of ideas, especially genre ideas. I use comics writing to get through a lot of stuff, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And he says, I'm dealing with folks who are now hesitant to hire me because of this. And I think personally that sucks. I don't like all of Cullen Bunn's writing, but I would never venture so far to say, oh, I like this stuff Cullen Bunn actually wrote, or something like that.
It's almost like saying he's plagiarizing in a sense,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely, yeah. Or that he's, you know, egotistical or not good at sharing or whatever, because obviously co-writing is a thing in comics and an important thing in comics.
Right.
And credit where credit's due and stuff, especially for, I don't know that a lot of comics writers have royalties deals, but it's important.
Sure. Especially, creator-owned stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. There are a ton of editors and writers and artists in the replies who also, like, quote, tweeted this and are standing up for Cullen and saying, Cullen works very hard and very fast, but I can tell you with assuredly that it is 100% him. He is one of the most professional comics writers I've ever worked with. He cares about the industry. He cares about people, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I personally, as a reviewer, I've been writing reviews since 2011-ish. I have no reason to believe any of that is untrue.
Do you suppose this is on par with that person accusing Tom King of not being in the CIA?
That was a fan.
Yeah.
I would say that this is almost worse. Stolen Valor is an issue, for sure.
Yeah.
But, like, this is someone who Cullen probably knows,
mm-hmm.
who is trying to take credit for his work, and is probably trying to do it intentionally to damage Cullen.
Right.
And I can't imagine it would make you... I honestly, I don't know if Cullen is this type of person, but I would be a little paranoid that... It goes the other way. I would start to be worried that other writers and artists and stuff are going to start stealing my work and my credit.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's a weird, messy, gross issue.
It's a weird one, too, because it's like, how do you prove it?
I guess you have dated drafts or dated documents.
Yeah,
I
suppose
stuff.
So. I mean, but, you know, writing, you're literally just pulling stuff out of nowhere.
Right.
You know? So
yeah,
it's,
I don't know.
It's, you don't usually, I don't think I've ever seen someone being accused of ghostwriting, unless they're some giant, giant novelist.
And I think that stuff happens. I mean, biographies.
Or like, you know, Tom Clancy or something. The people who like pull out like six books a year.
Yeah, right.
or even like Stephen King, who puts out at least two books a year.
I mean, the best, I'm not trying to accuse either of these guys of this, but yeah. The best example I can think of this was when we interviewed Dan Slott and he said, you know, I write the beats and Christos Gage writes the dialogue.
Right. But then Christos Gage's name credited. Is on the book.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
Right. It's too bad, but hopefully Bun can move on. I mean,
yeah, I mean, I'm sure he will. I was very, very heartened to see a ton of people from across the industry, from across publishers and across different positions in the industry come into his defense.
Yeah, that's always good. It's a small community. Everyone knows each other, especially because of conventions.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody's hanging out at conventions, so. And Bun's been at it for quite a while now. In our next bit of news, do you know a book called Strange Adventures by Tom King, Mitch Dirads, and Doc Shaner?
I've heard of it.
Well, you do now because I just said it. Well, apparently DC is rebranding it as a DC Black Label book. Which kind of comes out of nowhere. They released a preview and then just sort of subtly said it's a DC Black Label book now because it's got adult material in it.
I guess I'm kind of surprised that it wasn't originally.
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, it's a miniseries.
In my mind, I was like, yeah, that makes sense.
Here's the question I want to ask you. When Mr. Miracle came out, if they had DC Black Label at the time, would they have put it under that label?
Yes.
Because it's not technically in canon necessarily.
I mean, there are graphic depictions of sex and self-harm and violence.
Well, I'm thinking about canon though, like,
but I'm not, I'm thinking about Black Label as being the highest end of the age bracket model that DC released in middle 2019.
Right.
They have like the young readers, the middle-aged readers, and the adult books, which is ostensibly what Black Label's supposed to be.
See, from my perspective, it actually makes me ever so slightly less interested in it, knowing that it's not necessarily part of the bigger picture at DC.
I mean, I think comics is always going to be pick or choose canon,
mm-hmm.
and different things are going to matter to different writers and editors, and they can decide at any given moment that Dr. Manhattan says, actually, none of that is canon, or actually all of it is, right?
Right.
So it's always going to be that way. It's a transactional relationship where the reader just gets to pick the things that are canon to them and keep those things internally, I guess. But I would say when you're leading with Frank Miller, Greg Capullo, and Scott Snyder as kind of the headline books for Black Label, Batwing notwithstanding, I don't see any reason why they wouldn't be all in on it.
See, part of me just wonders, why didn't they just go to Image or something? They could make more money down the road.
They probably wanted to work with a specific character, I guess.
I guess, yeah.
There's got to be one person out there who really wants to tell an Adam Strange story.
Not to mention they can pull in like Darkseid or
right.
whatever
yeah.
as
right.
the story goes on.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was just a little surprised by it. In part also because when they announced it at San Diego Comic-Con last year, it wasn't part of the sell. Which could have potentially, you know, created even more stir.
I think the future of Black Label was uncertain
yeah.
at the time of San Diego.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I think it's doing a lot better now.
Right. So it's an easy call.
Yep, right. Yeah. And maybe an editor got the first issue and was like, holy shit, this dude's dick is out. We got to put this in Black Label.
That's funny, though, because, like, you know, DC could continue to just publish adult material in their regular books, just slap a warning on it, you know?
Yeah. Give me a fucking Catwoman Dominatrix book. I don't
there
care.
There you go. In yeah, canon. Whatever.
In canon.
And I want to see the scars on, I'm trying to think of a villain, Kite Man, the next time we see him over in Justice League.
Yeah, right.
In what universe is Kite Man showing up in Justice League?
This one, yeah.
Speaking of universes, Donny Cates is potentially creating a new one over at Image Comics in an event series. He started hyping the book on his Twitter,
mm-hmm.
and Bleeding Cool, which I took some of this information from, wrote up a little thing on it. And it appears it's a universe where God hates masks is one of the lines in it. That's not the name of the book, though. Donny came out and said that's not the name of the book. First of all, I thought Donny Cates was exclusive to Marvel.
I think the general rule with exclusivity is not the distinguished competition.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
You can take a story elsewhere as long as it's not a superhero story.
Yes. And also when you're doing fucking gangbusters at Marvel, they're probably like, yeah, all right, write your little indie book, whatever. Thanks for giving us a bajillion Carnage dollars.
Fans of God Country and Thanos are going to love that Jeff Shaw is on this as well.
Yeah.
So that's pretty cool. Are you excited for this book?
I am a huge fan of Donny Cates. I'm very, very excited for this whenever it comes out. And it sounds like it'll be a while. Although Rich Johnston of Bleeding Cool says that from what I've been told in private, this is sounding like a much needed summer hit for Image Comics. We've talked about Image Comics' woes with having a good headline title since Walking Dead ended. So that's cool. That's neat. I can see them going all in on Donny.
Yeah, I mean, Cates is so popular right now. Image would be silly not to try to rush this out.
Absolutely, yeah. I think of the comic book adaptation movies or indie comic book adaptation movies, it sounds to me like God Country's actually going to be a movie, too.
Oh, yeah.
So that's, That's a that's a great book.
Yeah, Cates was taking meetings with people, too, like a year ago. So we'll probably see it in the next 5 years.
Yeah, he wrote the script. It's done, as far as I know. So it makes sense to go all in on him.
Yeah, for sure. You know who else is getting all in on? Oh. DC on Tom King. Tom King was on Word Balloon, the other podcast you might be listening to if you like comics, which has been on much longer than us and is much more historic.
I also recommend Off Panel.
He has come out and said on the show that Alfred's death will be the setup of the up to the event of 5G. Yes, 5G. Also, you can get 5G on your phones if you call Verizon at... No, I'm sorry. But anyway, King...
AT&T thing. Got to get that brand, the synergy, bro.
King said that Batman losing Alfred starts the events that trigger 5G and says that him losing his connection to humanity as he regards Alfred as his real father, not this parallel Flashpoint version of Thomas Wayne. So... first of all, I just want to say, Alfred is dead in Detective Comics right now, and he's not losing his sense of humanity. So, I don't know what he's talking about. Maybe this is coming down the line. I don't know.
It would be okay to kill Alfred, and then a week later, they were like, oh shit, we got to make this matter.
Right.
Like, I'm not trying to be rude or diminutive to Tom King or anything like that. I'm pretty excited for Strange Adventures, but also I think they were like, wow, the backlash to this is way bigger than we expected.
Mm-hmm.
We gotta tie it into something.
Back to your synergy point, you know, Batman Pennyworth, rest in peace, number one is coming out next week. Was he like subtly trying to hype this book that he's not writing? A lot of great creators are involved with it, but it seems well-timed.
I'd say, I don't know, man. Okay. Okay.
Yeah, I don't know. What's fascinating to me is we keep hearing rumblings about 5G, but we have not seen one thing of certainty
around it. It's very interesting. Right.
Like in Doomsday Clock number 12, there's like talk of 5G as if it's something, but it's still nothing.
And it keeps it's weird inside baseball where literally anyone that is that into the DC universe already knows it's coming, already knows it exists. Right. Ritesh Babu for AAPTComics.com had enough information to write a breakdown of the next crisis. It's out there. I don't know why they're doing this. I don't know why DC is doing this.
I think they should just never release it, but keep hinting at it. That'd be amazing.
Maybe, yeah. And then, like, when they land on a story that they actually like or that actually has to matter, like Alfred dying, they can be like, oh, that was 5G. You didn't even notice.
Yes, yes. Say it after the fact when the sales are in.
That was 5G, yeah.
Just like the whole DC
Or they're going to reprint one book and be like, 5G number zero.
Oh, perfect. This is how it all makes sense now.
I swear to God we are not taking money from Marvel. I am just legitimately flabbergasted by DC's editorial decisions for the last, 2 years.
Yeah, I hope they write this ship because it still feels rocky.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't feel rocky. X-Men, which is the most popular thing on the face of the planet right now, if you read comics.
Three news pieces.
We have a lot of X-Men news coming up to end our news section here. Phantom X is appearing in Giant Size X-Men. Yeah, so this is the May issue, and Rod Rice is drawing the art.
Yes.
Who also joins Jonathan Hickman on New Mutants.
Yes.
Now, okay, just really quick. Jean Grey, yes. Emma is the first giant size. Yes. Then we have Magneto. Then we have Nightcrawler. And now Phantom X.
Mm-hmm. Weird company. Yeah.
I read a little bit of news on this, and I actually made the point in my news, like, it's kind of interesting that we have these, like, classic characters.
Yes.
And then Phantom X, who's much newer. And also, up in the air, we don't even know if Phantom X is, like, alive because of Xavier.
Yes.
Which, do you want to get into that?
I mean, we can just kind of break it down a little bit. I think people that are mostly caught up on X-Men lore, history, or whatever will know what's up. But basically, like, there was speculation at the beginning of House of X and Powers of X that Xavier was in Phantom X's body because Phantom X gave his body up to Xavier from the astral plane so Xavier could come back to life in a story called A Man Called X. Hickman didn't specifically deny that.
Right.
But he also didn't specifically grant it credence. There was also a lot of Phantom X stuff happening in the Weapons Plus books, which are still ongoing. So it seems to me that they are tying Phantom X into a bigger backside of Marvel history kind of thing.
So if you like backsides, you'll love this.
Yeah, that was weird phrasing. I don't know. but it's definitely like, this makes me think, all right, yeah, they are going to tell that story.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a story I want to be told, for sure. I think people are curious about this.
Yeah, I am. I've always liked Phantom X.
Me too. It's stupid. It's really dumb. That,
yeah. I like his ship, too. It's kind of weird looking.
Rick Remender's Uncanny is one of my... Uncanny X-Force is one of my most favorite comics of all time.
And yeah, and he wrote Phantom X amazingly.
Right. Absolutely. He's a great character. And he's totally stupid. He's like a fucking Quentin Tarantino espionage character slapped into the middle of the Marvel Universe. It doesn't make any sense.
Isn't he French or something?
Yes, it's weird. Yeah. I don't know. He's also called like the 13th child or something.
Doesn't
like that.
Doesn't he have like 18 brains or something?
Yes, and hearts, and I don't know what is up with him.
He hasn't been in the comics so long, I forget everything about him besides his cool costume.
But also, like, there's so much wild, buck wild stuff happening with him that I'm like, yeah, all right. Jonathan Hickman, the guy that made Gold Balls an Omega level mutant, can make this happen.
Oh, for sure.
You know?
Yeah. He's the most comics-y comic.
He's so mutant. Fucking dumb.
Yeah.
I'm very excited for it.
I'm also excited for Free Comic Book Day. Are you excited for
Free Comic Book Day? Excited for Free Comic Book Day.
I've always been so pumped, and to be perfectly honest, I'm always like, oh, it's over. Like, it ends.
Really? Huh. I mean, that's true. Yeah. The owner of the local LCS knows that I review comics. And a lot of the time when I go in there, he'll be like, here you go. Didn't you already read this?
Right.
And I'll be like, I mean, yeah, but I want a hard copy. And he, the last 2 years, has put aside a pile of all the Free Comic Book Day comics for me. Which is very nice. Yeah, because
a lot of LCSs only let you take two or three or whatever.
Like two or five, yeah.
Yeah. Although, to be honest, a lot of the Free Comic Book Day comics are reprintings, not necessarily new stuff like Marvel and DC puts out.
Yeah, with a new backup story or something, yeah.
So on Friday, Marvel revealed their two Free Comic Book Days. One is X-Men and one is Spider-Man Venom. Surprise, surprise.
Magic!
Hickman and Tom Taylor are writing the X-Men with Pepe Larraz and Ivan Coelho on art. And then on the Spider-Man book, it's Donny Cates, Jed McKay with Ryan Stegman and Patrick Gleason.
Yes. I love the way Patrick Gleason draws Spider-Man.
Yeah, he does a great job. And obviously Stegman is killer on Venom.
I cannot fucking believe that Venom is still like a headline front of the cover free comic book character, Free Comic Book Day character for like 3 years now. I'm having the time of my life over here, dude.
On the cover, Black Cat's on it. That's another surprise to me because...
Yes.
To be 100% honest, I really liked Jed McKay's first Catwoman arc, but I was like, when it was announced, I was like...
Black Cat, you mean?
Or sorry, Black Cat. Yeah. I was like, this is not going to last more than a single arc, but it's still going.
Away. Yeah.
Yeah. And obviously it's strong enough to throw her on the cover.
Book. Yeah.
Although she doesn't have name recognition on the cover like Spider-Man and Venom, though, unfortunately. Yeah.
But maybe she doesn't need it.
That's true.
Maybe people be like, woo! I don't know. the X-Men one I like also because I love Ilana Rasputin and Magic is front and center. She looks awesome. The sword looks great. Rogue is there. Storm. Wolverine is doing something, some sort of belly flop in the background. And then also Nightcrawler. And he has a sword too. So I will buy any comic. I'll make this promise right now. I will buy any comic that has two swords on the cover.
Wow. You know what? I'm going to hold to that every time I see a really terrible comic.
I'm going to be buying the Conan issues for the next 5 years.
I'm going to go call the publisher of like Xenoscope and tell him to put swords on the covers. No disrespect to Xenoscope. This really quick though, it also there's a note here that says there's a game-changing summer event for all of X that starts or is going to be involved in this Free Comic Book Day.
Yeah. But
obviously Free Comic Book Day is a way to lead into your big stories and create more interest. So that's a no-brainer there. Although people have been talking about DC's Free Comic Book Day,
yeah.
DC's Generation Zero, it's called, with a cover with Batman Who Laughs, a blue energy flash. It looks like something out of the 90s red, blue Superman.
Yeah.
Tons of heroes all over this cover. A reminder that DC has a bazillion heroes, but also a bazillion Supermen, because there's like a ton of them on the cover as well.
True.
So if you've been following comics Twitter, people are annoyed.
I do wonder if people talk about this in shops and stuff. Like, I bring it up because I know my LCS owner, Gus, and I are friends, and I know he knows this stuff.
Yeah.
But I wonder if people talk about it. I don't know.
Scott Lobdell and Brett Boother are doing this flash forward epilogue. My biggest problem is I did not like flash forward at all. It was not a well-crafted book, at least the first two issues until I dropped it.
Yeah.
So I don't know if the sales are up there for this. Probably not. But why put them on this book? I don't know.
I will say that Scott Lobdell, and we talked about this last week with Eric Esquivel and Eddie Berganza as well. He's one of the only comics writers with a controversy section on his Wikipedia page.
Right.
In 2013, Scott admitted to sexually harassing another comic book artist and writer during a panel, which is brazen and disgusting. He has a long history of this stuff. 2011, his portrayal of Starfire and Red Hood in The Outlaws. Yeah, it's just he has a long history of being abusive, of threatening physical and sexual violence. It makes me incredibly uncomfortable. It's absolutely wild to me. I mean, it's like when the Eric Esquivel stuff came out and DC was like, well, he's still on Nightwing for a couple weeks before they dropped him. And they've been protecting Lobdell for almost a decade, a decade, and I don't understand it.
And, he did write that.
And putting him front and center for Free Comic Book Day, I find, to be a gross, unjustifiable decision.
Yeah. He wrote that movie Happy Death Day. Some part of me wonders if, like, they want to, you know, kind of, he's, like, successful somewhat as a screenwriter to keep that like heat going or something. Maybe that's why. I don't know.
I guess. I don't know. I don't care for him. I don't care for DC's decision making here.
Right. And comics Twitter is really annoyed along with you and me.
Yeah. Yeah.
What they may not be annoyed with, because there hasn't been enough time to get annoyed, is our last bit of news. Juggernaut number one has been announced. Yes, another X-Men book. Another book we need.
Yeah. There's not two swords on this one, so I don't have to buy it.
If only Juggernaut always wielded two swords. this one's written by Fabian
Nischeka
and Ron Garney with a cover by Jeff Shaw. So right off the bat, the creative team here, these guys have been working in the comic industry for quite a while. Now, Fabian hasn't been working, you know, a ton lately, but I mean, the guy is known for co-creating Deadpool.
Yes.
Unless you ask Rob Liefeld. Sorry.
Yes. Yeah, true.
Sorry. I had to get that dig in. This is coming out in May. So ahead of the May solicitations, which will come out the end of the month. But are you excited to read more Juggernaut?
I guess.
It's a 5-issue miniseries, by the way. So it's not going to be an ongoing. Unless it sells like hotcakes, of course.
I have never been big on the Juggernaut.
Yeah.
Is what is the Spider-Man story? Nothing can stop the Juggernaut.
Yeah.
Is Amazing Spider-Man 229 to 230. I almost had it. Almost said 240.
Oof, so close.
I love that story a lot, but I have not much cared for the Juggernaut outside of that.
I mean, he's kind of a simplistic character, right?
Yeah, sure. As far as I know. I'm excited about a Phantom X comic, so what do I know?
Someone needs to write a Juggernaut story where he goes to a buffet.
Ooh. All right. I know. Yeah. Hey, that's right up there with Hear Me Out, Two Swords.
There you go.
Yeah.
So that's it for news, folks. We'll be back next week with more news. But before we get there, Lonnie Nadler and Zach Thompson coming up later. But before we get there, top books of last week. We're going to talk about our
like a trailer before the trailer.
Favorite comics out last week. And to start this segment, we're going to bring up the top fan and top critic pick from comicbookroundup.com. Mm-hmm. The top critic pick, no surprise, Martian Manhunter number 12 with a 9.9.
This is the final issue of Steve Orlando and Riley Rossmo's DC Maxi series around Martian Manhunter. It's fantastic. But why though, writer Aaron Phillips gave it a 10 and says, get Martian Manhunter on your pull list and read it until you're green in the face. This is a series I will recommend for a long time.
Comicbook.com, but it's over.
Jenna Anderson also says, Martian Manhunter is the kind of book that deserves to be read by every DC fan for many years to come. So that's awesome. And yeah. I would assume that very soon they're going to do some sort of prestige treatment for this.
Oh, for sure.
And I will purchase that.
The top fan pick was Daphne Byrne, number 2, with a 9.8. I reviewed this at AFGComics.com.
I like the little twang you put on it.
I thought this was a fantastic issue. It totally deserves this high score because I was a little wishy-washy after issue 1. But number 2, I was like, hell yeah, give me those monsters.
Yeah, User Azriel gave it a 9.5 and said, much better than the first issue. This issue delivered on bringing a feeling of horror, making the lead character more compelling, and telling a fun story. Hopefully this pace is kept up. So that's great. I like a lot of the Hill House stuff. I like what they're doing. It's neat.
Yeah, for sure. It's been rather great.
Yeah.
Rather great. If you go back into our episodes, you can listen to Joe Hill talk about the entire line.
He did a really fun like one sentence or one word pitch for each of the titles.
Yes. That's
fantastic. It really kind of shaped my understanding of Hill House as a cohesive line as an individual books. And I've gone back and listened to that and enjoy kind of diving into the idea he saw as an editor for each of the titles.
For sure. Yeah. And yeah, we've had other Hill House comics writers on, and it's interesting how he's curating that line too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sort of like managing it and helping the creators, some of which have never written comics before, break in.
Yeah.
So, what is your second favorite comic of last week?
My second favorite comic of last week is the Immortal Hulk Great Power one-shot written by Tom Taylor with art by Jorge Molina. If you had told me before I read this issue today that Hulk and Spider-Man were kind of the same character, I would say you're crazy. However, Tom Taylor does a really fantastic job in this issue with some levity that I really appreciated given how heavy Immortal Hulk is right now and how deep it is, exposing that Peter Parker and Bruce Banner are really just characters that are burdened by responsibility. And they grow to appreciate each other over the course of this single issue, largely because Spider-Man becomes the Hulk. But also because they have a much deeper understanding for what it's like to have that kind of superheroic calling in the back of your head that both of them have that drives them forward. There's also a really, really fantastic running gag of people putting on Fantastic Four shirts and other people saying, do you not know how to count?
Right.
Because there's way more than four of them. Which I really enjoyed. I thought it was funny, I thought it was heartfelt, and I thought it kind of exposed a similarity between these two characters that I like, or thought I liked for separate reasons, into one cohesive thing.
On top of all that, I know we both voiced concerns a couple of weeks ago. It has a decent explanation for how it even happened.
Yes, that's true. It did. Yeah. And it didn't feel like it was detracting from the Immortal Hulk title to me.
No, yeah, it's
its own thing. It gave a bit of time to Bruce, which is admittedly a little lacking in Immortal Hulk right now.
That's true. Good point. Because, I mean, if it was simple for Hulk to just change to hero, I mean, we'd have Venom again.
Yeah, right. I do, I kind of wanted a Tom Taylor-written Loki book after this also.
Oh, for sure. Like, give me Tom Taylor anything.
Yes. But also the way he writes Loki in this is really funny. Loki keeps reiterating that he's trying to be a good guy now. Mm-hmm. And then Peter and Bruce and the Fantastic Four are walking away from him. And he goes, does this get to count as a team up?
Right.
And
right.
Johnny's like, no.
It actually made me heartsick a bit because Daniel Kibble-Smith's off Loki.
True.
It reminded me that he kind of, you know, curated that a little bit with his five-issue run. So my second favorite book out last week is After Realm Quarterly, number one, by Michael Avon Oeming and Taki Soma on colors. This is an extra-sized fantasy issue book thing that's awesome. It's visually stunning. Oeming does the art and the writing, of course. What's really cool is by the time you get to the end of the book, he gives you four different panels explaining what inspired him to make this series. And one was D&D, one was 80s arcade games. I won't give you the other two. You have to read it to find out. But then he, a little bit later, gives you four more panels about what issue number two will be, which was crazy far out and not a fantasy necessarily. Hmm. So basically, really quick, the issue basically explains there's like a Ragnarok thing going on. There isn't a Thor character, but there is a Loki character.
Okay.
But it's not Marvel at all. It's just Image Comics.
Is there a serpent? Or a wolf?
There is a giant wolf that bursts out of the earth to eat the sun.
Yep, that's Ragnarok, baby.
Yeah, so just that visual alone is a full page splash. It's amazing.
That's awesome.
There's some interesting visual tricks going on. I call it tricks because the use of color and like neon color and like almost like a repetitive sort of color outline
motif,
creates
maybe.
Yeah, it creates like a sense of motion that's really cool. You're introduced to the main character who wants to escape from all these elves hide underground, but her friend is up there on the surface world and she wants to save him or at least make sure that they're all right. But the elves are like, nah, we're staying down here and we're just going to ignore anything that's going up there. Exactly.
No.
If you're into politics, I think there's a subtle connection there to sticking your head in the sand and letting everything just carry on. But yeah, I was stunned also by the extra size of it. It's a different kind of story. You're not just getting 20 pages, so it just kept going and it was entertaining, very entertaining.
Cool. Neat.
Yeah. So what is your favorite book?
We have the same favorite book. Do you just want to tackle them together?
He will tag team it.
So we both this week, our number one pick is X-Men plus Fantastic Four, number one, written by Chip Zdarsky with art by Terry Dodson. I will say, hearkening back to what I was just saying about the ongoing joke in Tom Taylor's one shot.
Yeah.
When I opened this and the front or the first page has a breakdown of who the X-Men are in the issue and who the Fantastic Four are in the issue. And there was more than four Fantastic Four. I was like, this is why people hate comics.
Right.
However, aside from that, I thought it got the Fantastic Four really right.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he really wrote the kind of weird power struggle family dynamic that they have. And also kind of like Ben as an outsider watching that, but caring deeply and trying to check Reed when he needs to be checked, especially in relation to his son, Franklin, being a mutant and Xavier and Magneto and stuff wanting him for Krakoa. I thought it was really well written and I don't normally care about the Fantastic Four.
Yeah, it's a reminder that the family element is a huge part.
Yes.
Of the team.
Yeah.
And we see that when Invisible Woman sticks Magneto into a bubble.
Yeah.
And is like, get the hell out of my house.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the issue, she says, I would have killed them.
Right.
Which I was kind of, I like how true that is of a mother or any parent. And then also like how doubly scarily true it is for a fucking superhero.
That's what I like the most about this issue, the domestic element, mm-hmm. because yeah. If you're a parent, or obviously if you've had parents, you know that they can be overprotective and they mean well, but especially if you're young and you're dealing with this from an overbearing parent, it can literally drive you mad. Yeah. And that's something that Franklin's going through, and you can kind of understand Franklin's point of view and Reed and Sue's point of view.
Yeah, and then I think you have kind of the extenuating circumstance, which is the mutants or X-Men mm-hmm. and Krakoa, right? Because a lot of Dawn of X has been about the dichotomy or the difference between mutants and the mutant nation and mutant society, mutant fashion, mutant powers, mutant communication, as compared to human, right? And the clash right. between those two cultures. And it postures that humans are the bad guy. And I agree with that. I think the case has been very well made across real life history and also in comics history. But this issue takes a little bit of a more nuanced, scalpel-like approach to say, well, what about the people that fall in between those two things?
Which is one of the reasons why I love Excalibur so much, because Betsy Braddock is dealing with that, because mm-hmm. she's
yeah.
the protector of the humans in the UK, but also a mutant herself.
Right, yes.
And her brother, of course, is human, mm-hmm. and she can't reject her brother, even though some people are telling her to.
Right, yeah. They explore different themes, or the same theme, through different lenses. Mm-hmm. Well, also, you know, I personally don't agree that the mutants are the bad guy in this, but I really liked Reed tells Xavier at some point in the issue, Franklin will come to you when he wants to. It's just a matter of time. The fact that you have a timetable is what scares me.
Right.
And I thought that that was really interesting, because you basically have, like, the two smartest characters in the Marvel Universe at odds.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's really interesting.
You know, it's interesting you keep saying that the mutants are the good guys, because I got a bad guy vibe from Xavier when he's asking Kate Pride, you know, to use yeah, her relationship.
Totally manipulative. Yes.
And that's shitty of him. Yes. I don't care if he has good intentions. That is, like, you know, I don't like manipulators. And especially in that shot. They did this on purpose, I mean, of course.
That's Xavier's whole character arc. I'm not saying Terry Dodson, Xavier's a good guy.
You cover someone's eyes, anybody, even if they're, yeah. like, you know, the best person in the world, and you're going to not trust them.
That's
and
Hickman's he has this, trick, baby.
Yeah, and yeah. he has this crazy grin on his face, and you're just like, I don't yeah. like this yeah, guy.
No, absolutely. Like, I am not at all saying that Xavier is a good guy. The argument could maybe be made for Magneto, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I would have that argument, and I think Magneto is right in a lot of regards. But I'm talking more about the societal clash rather than individuals, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's interesting, right. I think, is what we're both circling around, to see that play out on the domestic level.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Because I'm going to hesitate to say this, because uh-oh. People all around America are having conversations about the differences between Trump and Bernie.
Uh-huh.
And this parallels that extremism and the kind of mundanity of it in normal people's lives very well.
Hmm. Interesting. I also love the fact that Thing is just a great uncle and is yes, like talking yeah, to Franklin for sure. He was like a person.
I love the idea of him being like, you want to go get a milkshake, kid? Like,
I actually said this in my review too, like when he talks to Storm in one scene, they're like all chill with Thing.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. he's not an asshole like Reed. Like, people kind of hate Reed
yeah.
for obvious reasons. But, like, I said this in a review, like, I bet Thing could go to Krakoa and they'd be like, all right, cool.
Yeah, what's up, dude?
You can hang with us.
What's up,
exactly,
man?
Yeah. And that was a nice little thing. Because, I mean, you know, you have to love Thing. The poor guy is a sad dude.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I think I liked all the nuance and the way that Zdarsky is teasing out these different interpersonal conflicts. Right? Like, I think Reed kind of knew that he fucked up when Ben was like, hey, dude, that's a yeah. shitty thing to do to your kid.
Yeah, it's a spoiler, but he wipes the mutant DNA off of him so you can't track him.
Yeah, he invalidated Franklin's mutant gene, so he right, can't even pass through the gates to Krakoa.
If you think about that, the implications of that in the real world and what that meant as the father figure to
it's like
you
castration,
know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
Or something, yeah.
Yeah.
It's messed up. Yeah, I'm really interested to see where this goes. especially with the cliffhanger and the relationship of the person in the cliffhanger with one of the characters on the boat.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really, anywho, it's really, really good.
It's too bad it's a miniseries. I think it's only 5 issues.
You know what? I think if Chip has a specific story he wants to tell, yeah, I'm down for that.
Okay. In our next segment, we're going to talk about books coming out next week. Top books for next week. And yeah, so we're just going to talk about our number one book coming out next week. There are a lot of comics out next week. I think, let me just check right here. DC has 18 comics coming out next week. You know how many books are coming out from Aftershock?
One.
Just one.
Yeah, just I was one. Like, is this a good question?
Sorry. I didn't set you up, but I didn't realize it was unfair.
I got it right. It's yeah, okay.
My most anticipated book out next week is Undone by Blood by Zach Thompson and Lonnie Nadler, who are on the show later. Art by Sammy Cavalla. I think this is a great first issue, especially if you like Westerns. It's dealing with two different storylines, one in 1971 and one way back when there were cowboys. And there's a fascinating use of lettering by, Hassan
Otsmane Alahu, I think.
Thank you.
Yeah. Editor of Panel by Panel.
Yes. There, it just feels like a prestigious book, in that it's just so well done across the board. And if you like revenge tales or a mystery, a good mystery, check this book out.
Yeah, it's a... they talk about it a little bit in their interview, but I was really struck by the, like, what if you took a Park Chan-wook movie or a Quentin Tarantino movie and made those people seeking vengeance deal with the consequences of their actions?
Right.
It's interesting. I like it a lot. Lonnie and Zach are very, very cerebral, and they have a lot of thoughts about thematics, and you can tell about the scope and shape of their narrative and in imbuing a book with history and also homages and stuff like that, but never in a way that I feel is like talking down to me. Like I was like, while reading it, we had the privilege of reading the first two issues, I was kind of struck by like, this is a Western about Westerns. But not in a way that's like how I was struck originally by Peter Cannon.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
It's very good.
Yeah, I'm excited to see Westerns, too. You don't see them too often.
Back in the blogosphere, baby.
What is your most anticipated book out next week?
My most anticipated book out next week is written by my favorite comics writer, Cy Spurrier, with art by Christian Wildgoose, and it is a book called Alienated. This is the first issue from, I believe it's Boom, right?
Yep.
Yeah, Boom. Mm-hmm. It is about three kids... all named Sam, who stumble across something in the woods that irrevocably changes their lives, their relationship to one another, and also kind of their place in the little microcosm of their school. It's really, really interesting. It's really endearing. It's like so tonally different from what Cy is writing over in Hellblazer right now. But I really liked it a lot, and first issues can be a gambit between like, oh wow, that was a big whiff, and like, oh man, I need the second issue right now. And this is one of the ones that made me feel like I needed the second issue right away.
There is quite a twist at the end.
There is, yeah. It was and it wasn't like a like cheap cliffhanger.
No.
I felt, and I trust Cy to tell a story that deserves that. So I was really excited by it. It's very like millennial feeling. It's very smart and cerebral, but also kind of emotionally raw and resonant. I just like it a lot.
Yeah, we should say, we got to read it early because we're going to get to interview Cy Spurrier for next week's show.
I'm flipping out a little bit.
I'm pretty excited.
I have not vocalized that as of now.
Oh, to me, you mean?
We are going to be interviewing Cy Spurrier. And he's just a man, whatever. I'm sure he's going to be very nice and very cool. But I'm excited about it.
You know, and people are very excited for Alienated because it's already sold out.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And they're fast tracking it to a second printing out March 3rd. So you may not be able to find this book next week.
Womp womp.
Because it's sold out. But if you're lucky enough, you can check that out. In our next segment, Judging by the Cover Junior, we pick our favorite cover art out next week. And Force.
Yes.
What's your favorite cover art?
My favorite cover art out next week is the third issue, the variant cover of Doctor Strange, Surgeon Supreme. This is cover art by Kev Walker. It features the silhouette of Doctor Strange. You can tell because he's got that pointy cape. walking into an emergency room where red smoke and ethereal light is pouring out, kind of wrapped around him like it might be if you left a fog machine on all night at a party or something.
And I hate when that happens.
I hate it. And then you can actually see in like the very top, I would say like sixth of the cover, is a bunch of like outworld ass looking demons and evil and weird cosmic magic bullshit, multiverse bullshit. There's someone like beating against the glass, being eaten by what looks to be just a hole made of teeth and eyes. So I liked it a lot. It's very foreboding, but honestly, I think still a little playful.
Well, yeah, for sure.
And
the use of color is cool too.
Fucking every time, dude. I bet if you put all my covers next to each other, you'd be like, man, he picks monochromatic covers 9 out of 10 times.
We should do that sometime.
I really like it. It's good.
My favorite cover art comes from a trade paperback, Dawn of X, Volume 1. I credit Tom Muller, but it's also by a hell of a lot of artists. Leonel Francis Yu, Sonny Goh, Russell Dodderman, Matthew Wilson, Mahmoud Asrar, Rod Rice, Dustin Weaver, and Ashley Witter. There's basically a collage of all their art that's only covering, I'd say, 30% of the cover. The rest is a big white X in the Tom Muller font. And then most of the cover is gray. I love how he has... So I'm giving credit to everyone, but I love Tom Muller's graphic design here. And I was talking to a graphic design friend of mine a week ago, actually. And I was like, what do you think of his covers? Because I was showing him a lot of his variant covers, which are pretty artistic, very almost abstract. And he was telling me, this looks a lot like video game art, or it's trying to capture the interest of the video game audience. And I immediately was like, wow, that's crazy. I don't know if that's true or not, but it's a wild idea if it is. Because how clever if, I don't know if Tom Muller is even aware of it himself, but if they're trying to draw the interest of fans of video games, which is a huge industry in itself, into comic industry, that's a genius move. It's just very clean and just very appealing to the eye. And if you go to AIPTcomics.com and go to this podcast post, you can see both of those covers.
Yeah.
So we are next up on segment. Zach Thompson and Lonnie Nadler. We're going to be interviewing them both about Undone by Blood, about them wrapping up Yondu at Marvel Comics. And yeah, it's going to be a fun time.
It was great.
Okay, and with me is Zach Thompson and Lonnie Nadler. We have Undone by Blood coming out on the 12th, February 12th. Thank you guys so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
So Undone by Blood is your new Aftershock series. I would describe it as a modern and also classical Western revenge thriller. Does that seem fair?
I mean, it's better than I could describe it.
Okay, all right, cool. Can you guys tell us a little bit about the world of Undone by Blood and maybe other stories or media or research that inspired it? Zach, you post a lot of mood boards for your projects on social media. Do you have any remembering of what this one looked like?
I mean, there's definitely some Coen brothers on there. One of the first choices Lonnie and I made were like, we want to populate this book with weirdos. People whose like faces like chew up a panel and really just like they seem like oddballs just from looking at them, which is something the Coen brothers do really well. Then definitely some Cormac McCarthy in there, which you can put a page of prose on the mood board.
I was going to say the kind of more classical story in there is very Blood Meridian.
Yeah, and. What else, Lonnie? What else you got?
There's a lot of Sergio Leone in that would like. No, Zach and I are like, we both love Once Upon a Time in the West, and we probably talked about that movie every time we scripted at some point. But there were Zach and I, when we script, we talk a lot about, we give a lot of direction in our panels, and probably like I don't know, at least a dozen of them say, it's like this Sergio Leone style shot from this movie. And so there was a lot of that going into it.
There's a sequence in issue two that's pretty much lifted directly from a moment in Once Upon a Time in the West, and like homage. And it's what leads into the two-page sequence. You guys read the issue. And then Sammy rendered it with beautiful, beautiful detail and made it like a two-page width panel. Oh my God. Yeah. I want to spoil it for people before it even comes out in March.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. We talked about, I think the original thing that sort of set Zach and I off to want to do this, other than just like wanting to write a Western, was we both saw a movie called Nocturnal Animals. That was what, like 2017 or something, Zach?
Yeah, this project is older, in its inception at least, and that it was like the second thing we pitched to Aftershock almost immediately after seeing that movie.
Yeah, and the movie, have you guys seen that movie?
It's the Paul Thomas Anderson one, I've seen it, yeah. Right?
No, it's Tom Ford directed it.
Tom, really? I have seen it, but I definitely thought it was Tom Ford.
I remember thinking it was very weird and slow, but I don't know, maybe I was in the wrong mood.
I know a lot of people disliked it, but Zach and I saw it twice, and Zach, yeah. We both were just like floored by mostly the way that it sort of... had these two interwoven narratives that really complemented one another, but wasn't on the nose about it. And we just like couldn't stop talking about the movie. And I think that led us to be like, well, we also want to do a Western. So like, how the fuck can we combine these two crazy things? Because I think we knew we wanted to do a Western, but we didn't want to just do a ripoff of Sergio Leone or something like that. It had to be like something more interesting. So that was another thing I remember we talked about a lot. And
something else like, came to me.
Yeah, go
Wild,
ahead.
Wild at Heart.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
We are both in love with that David Lynch movie, and there's a character in it in particular who almost came to us first. It was the first character we created in Undone by Blood, and it came so quickly that was inspired by that film. And I won't talk about it too much because you haven't met that character in Undone by Blood yet. But it's sort of like everything sort of spiraled out from there in terms of like who these people were. And I remember just Lonnie and I are really sort of fueled by making weirdos, people who are so strange that you sort of like need to tell this story about them.
Yeah.
And I think this character was one who we couldn't shake. And like, we would be working on other books and be talking about this guy and like who he could be and what he could do. And like literally like to the point where, I don't know, I remember like, I could go down like, a rabbit hole.
I was like taking pictures of people on the subway and sending them to that.
That's awesome.
Like, this is him, man. Like, I found him in real life.
That's funny. You're like, the weirder you make them, maybe the more realistic they seem to become.
Totally. That's like exactly what we think. And like, you know, talking about these weirdos on screen and stuff is like, Zach and I both just saw Uncut Gems, and that's full of like real life weirdos, and we love that kind of thing.
Yeah, man.
The only other thing I just want to add before we talk about more weirdos is, I think Zach and I would be remiss if we didn't mention that Park Chan-wook was a big influence on this, in the way that he tells revenge stories. Like Zach and I, we actually had written this to be linear completely, and then we were like, oh, no, we're doing revenge stories wrong. And we, like, completely rebuilt it. Crazy.
Yeah, that was a tough day, too, because we sat down to write it linearly. And I don't remember how we got to this point, but we sat down to begin the first issue. And we were both like, something doesn't feel right. And we literally took apart the whole outline that we had for all five issues and put together like a puzzle sort of structure.
So now like what was the first issue is now the last issue.
Oh, that's amazing.
I can totally see the Lady Vengeance in it now that you mentioned that. Exactly.
So when you were rebuilding the script or the structure, was that where the two-story structure kind of came into place?
That was always there. It was just Ethel's story in particular was like, we originally started it so that like the first issue was like the murdering of her family.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Oh, okay.
And
understood.
Then we were like, well, that's just not very mysterious or very interesting. And so we had to just like completely rework the way we were telling it. And like, and then it became, instead of like, she knows who it is, it became like a mystery of her trying to find out who it was.
When you have two stories taking place separate from each other, do you have to do extra research or extra note taking in order to keep it all together while you're kind of building it out?
Yes.
Yeah. It's not fun, but it is fun in its own way. But like, it's just, yeah, you can go down some real rabbit holes, especially given that like you're building two things that are set in two separate storylines that each have their own rules. And the amount of times we've had to hold each other accountable because of certain things that we've set out, where it's like, you know, you have to remember which states were actually established in 1892.
And we fucked that one up.
Yeah. And where you're going and like how to, and like, you know, looking at a map of the United States in that era, making sure that like the things you're depicting in the backgrounds of the frontier are accurate. You know, like it was, it seemed fun at first, and then it was a lot of work.
So yeah. And then it's like, and then you double that because we're doing it for two time periods. So
right,
it's like,
yeah, like what kind of toy can be on the desk of a certain office?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
like,
yeah,
you know, Zach and I are obviously people who do a lot of research, you know, from talking to me before, but it's like, here we had to do it twice as much because we wanted it to be, you know, well Sweetheart is the town that it takes place in is a fictional town, it's still like we wanted things to feel authentically like they were in 1971.
And that's why everyone's smoking in every fucking panel and every opportunity we ever could put in there. There's just so much cigarette smoke in this book.
Yeah. And you just like Google the weirdest stuff. Like there's a character who's drinking milk out of one of those like curly straws that like looks like a heart. And we had to Google like, did they have like curly straws in the 1970s? And it's like, it's just this kind of writer thing you do, or like, oh my God, it has to be accurate. But then at the same time, it's like, well, who the fuck is going to be like, they didn't have straws like that in 1971? This sucks.
I remember.
I wanted to say, sorry, if there's, are you worried someone's going to like tweet at you? Like, how fucking dare you put a Felix the Cat toy on the desk?
Yes. But that's the thing. It's like, being a writer is like, part of it, a big part of it is like, no one else is going to care about this shit. And so you have to, because while other people might not recognize it, the amount of work you put into building a world can be felt. Like, you know, you guys noticed, for example, the Felix the Cat toy. We chose to put that in the script because we, like, it says something about the character and the era. But like, you know, maybe if we were less, deliberate in the way that we script, we wouldn't have put anything in there, and then it wouldn't have had the same feeling.
Or you know, Sammy doesn't care by extension, and then put something in from like the year 2000 on the desk, right? But it takes place in 1971. So there's a lot of like just making sure that every ounce of care and thought that we can put in, and also just from loving comics, you want to fill panels with subtext about who people are and telling it like, if you're not going to use a visual medium to tell stories in the background, then what are you doing?
I have a friend who wanted to be a set dresser on movie sets. And I never didn't even know there was a job like that. And you guys are kind of doing that while filling the scenes.
Yeah, that like we Zach and I always think of it as like, you know, we're writing, but we're also doing production design, and we're also doing, and we're also directing. And then, you know, the artist comes in, and it's sort of like at that point they're doing cinematography and co-directing. It's just like we like to put the work in, I guess. And we see scripting, I think, differently than a lot of people. Not saying it's better or worse. It's just you know, it's kind of the only way we know how to do it at this point.
So how do you guys on the day-to-day go about splitting up the work for a co-written title? Is one of you on dialogue, well, one of you's on research, and then you check each other's work, or...?
Nah, man. I mean, you know, the easiest way to explain it is we both do all of it. We literally both do different types of research. Usually, like, we split out and go like, okay, I'll go look for this thing, you go look for that thing. But we come together after the separate fact-finding missions. we sit in a room and we both have the same Google Doc open and we literally write at the same time and we have discussions about everything and wow. every line. And I think we're the only co-writers who literally do it. We sit in the same room and we do it end to end, which is part of the reason I think that our voice together is seamless, right? There's no bumps. I'm not saying that there's other co-writers out there that aren't or are bumpy. I'm just saying that I feel like when we write together, you can't really go like, oh, that was Zach or that was Lonnie or whatever. It's because it's all of us all the time.
Do you bounce ideas off each other for your solo titles like Black Stars Above and Replacer? Where do you personally feel like the co-creator credit line starts?
I mean, we're also like best friends. So I, sure. yeah, I think we talk about a lot of stuff. I think there is some more I'm definitely more guarded with my solo stuff, and I'm sure Lonnie is too. It's because if we start getting feedback from the guy that you're writing with all the time, you're also not exploring your own impulses and stuff, you know, like if that makes any sense. Because it's like,
sure, yeah,
we spend a lot of time collaborating. So like, you know, and the other side, you have to kind of also go like, okay, what do I think about this on my own? It's hard though. We both experience difficulties with like not having another person in the room, I think. Because it's like it's like having your editor with you when you're co-writing like this, you know.
That's what Lonnie said last time when he was on the show.
yeah.
So this is a Western, obviously. What are your top three Westerns, books or movies?
Zach, if you've got yours, please spare me.
I can give two. I don't know. Three. Blood Meridian is probably my favorite Western novel. Reading that was actually like a really, I don't know. It was like a lightning bolt hit my fucking brain where I was like, oh my God, I got to be a writer. Like it just unbelievable and still is with me to this day. And I leaf through it all the time. And then Once Upon a Time in the West, similarly, when I was like 16, I was going down this rabbit hole of like Dario Argento and Sergio Leone. And then when I found Once Upon a Time in the West, I was like, oh my word. I don't know why I love it as much as I do, but it's probably one of my favorite films of all time. You know, it's beautiful end to end. It's epic and sweeping and it's got a beautiful score. And I don't know, I could watch that movie endlessly, even though it is like 3 hours and 15 minutes long.
There's so many stunning shots in that movie.
Yeah. I have four, but like it's, two of them are a tie because they're both books by the same guy.
Okay.
So, one of them is Once Upon a Time in the West. The other one is The Assassination of Jesse James by the Ford.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. That one's good.
And then the other would be a tie between Outer Dark and The Crossing, Cormac McCarthy.
Yeah. Oh, awesome. Nice. Yeah, I can see all that kind of DNA in Undone by Blood as well. And I would imagine that darkness and stuff only kind of compounds as we continue. That's all Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid Erasure, but that's fine. We talked about time periods a little bit before and making sure the set dressing is right and everything, but is there significance to the time periods that you chose? For example, Once in 1971.
We don't do anything without it having a reason to like to our detriment sometimes.
I mean, like you can get into like we could get into the weeds here big time if you want, but like 1971, you can look at it as like the heyday of the Western in sort of American culture, but also sort of the last era of American history that also was very like wild and crazy and sort of like, you know, there's a huge swell of violence in American culture at that point too. And then like the time period with Saul, 1892, which I don't think we ever state outright.
Yeah, I don't think you did.
Yeah, I didn't notice it.
I was looking for it.
Yeah, which is towards the end of the West, you know, right before things are kind of settled there. And we also did that for a variety of reasons. It sort of puts everyone within the world at a state of desperation, a state of like on the precipice of change, sort of this uneasiness about what the future holds for everyone. And it makes men more desperate. throughout the series, as you'll see.
So I have a question about the writing process when you're picking time periods like that. Do you externalize to each other the kinds of things you just said? Like, hey, I want to find a time period where everyone's life fucking sucks.
Well, yeah, I think it's kind of like we know like what we want to talk about with the book in terms of like themes and stuff. And so it's about finding time periods that best go towards communicating whatever it is we're trying to say. And so the book for us is largely about the influence of the Western and the myth of the Western and the cowboy on American culture and how it sort of impacted everything from our television shows to the way that we see violence and guns in America. And so 1892 felt right because, you know, it's the end of that era, quote unquote, but then 71 was sort of like Zach said, it's when like the movies, they stopped making Western movies basically after the second resurgence. So it's like these two time periods where the West is quote unquote dead, but really the West is so, and the Western is so ingrained in American culture that like it never goes anywhere. And so we wanted just two time periods that really reflected the idea of the myth and carrying the myth forward and how we see it manifested in reality.
It is impossible to ask you guys a gotcha question. It sounds like you've got everything planned to a T. Why was there a rock in panel 4? Well, I'll tell you why there's a rock in panel 4. It's impressive. It's impressive, I have to say. Does the title or genre of a book often come before the plot of the story for you guys?
A title usually comes last. Zach and I struggle with titles.
Interesting.
And right at the pitch process sometimes too, where we're like, we have to come up with the title now. And then we like are thinking about something that will inevitably change. Like we fought really hard to get the title for this book and then it changed.
We had a different title for this and we had to change it because someone else released a Western with that name.
Yeah. Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
What are the chances?
Yeah.
Slim. Yeah. Yeah.
And it wasn't like a normal title for Western either. So we were just like, God damn it. Like, of course this fucking happened to us. But yeah, I don't know. Titles are hard. And obviously our titles are always like kind of out there. So
makes Do it you hard. Find it easier or harder to sell or pitch genre stories? What did kind of the original pitch for Undone by Blood look like?
Oh, it was like straight. It was a Western right away.
Yeah. Yeah. I think genre is a really good way to trick publishers. I shouldn't say this on a podcast, but it's true.
Yeah.
In that, like, you can hide some more nuance using the lens of genre that you probably couldn't do if you played this straight.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Like, I don't know how to articulate, like, I guess if we set this in like the modern day and had everything sort of play out the same way, I don't think it would be as strong, one, because of the themes that we're exploring are so tied to Westerns. But and like, I don't think Aftershock would be prone to looking at something like that either. I think you can like, genre is a great lens.
Have you ever pitched something like as a Western and then like the editor was like, what if it was in space though?
Oh God.
I would just say no.
you'd flip the table and walk out.
I wouldn't even, I would just say nothing and walk out.
No. So what do you guys like about revenge stories?
I mean, I guess that's a tough question because for me at least, I like some revenge stories, but I don't like a lot of them because they have to be, I don't like revenge stories that are simply there to glorify the idea of revenge or revenge stories that are like, there's a movie that came out a couple years ago that I saw that like everyone was raving about and I saw it and I was just kind of like, well, it's just putting a twist on the revenge story just for the sake of it, but it wasn't particularly good other than that. And I think if you're doing a revenge story, you owe it to your audience and to yourself to be saying something other than like, to be doing it other than just for telling a revenge story. Like I get nothing out of that. And I think we sort of wanted this to almost be like the antithesis of a Tarantino revenge movie.
Yeah, it wasn't
about the violence,
and consequences, I think, are a big thing. Revenge is often depicted as sort of like a really good means to an end, and we're really concerned about sort of like, well, what would logically happen in this scenario, and how would this sort of, how do we watch a character descend deeper into like, you know, bad decision after bad decision, but we empathize with them. And then, you know, you can't just have everything resolve in a really happy ending and make this all go away, right? And
yeah.
We had a long debate about this, the ending of this book, because of that, including with the publisher. They're like, "Are you sure?" And we're like, "We're sure. We're doing it this way."
Nice.
And they were like, "Well, maybe when you get to the end, you'll like want to revise it." And we were like, "Yeah, yeah, okay." And then we just scripted it.
We didn't.
Okay, so one thing I wanted to talk about was layout design. In issue 2, the gutters serve as the prison bars. I was like blown away. The angle at which it was drawn was amazing. I'm wondering, from a writer's perspective, do you have like a treasure chest of layout ideas that you might have saved up for later? Or is it something that you just come up with while you're writing?
I mean, Zach and I outline heavily, and sometimes it comes while we're outlining that it's just like, okay, what's the point of this page? How many panels will it need? Well, wouldn't it be cool if we did this? But sometimes it's like we're writing a page and we're like, well, it doesn't feel right. Like, what are we trying to say? How can we make it more interesting? What, you know, what can we do with layout that would complement what's occurring on the page? So it just kind of, we always try to make whatever we're doing formalistically be influenced by what's happening narratively, because otherwise it just becomes sort of superfluous. And then we would obviously be remiss if we didn't talk about Sammy, because as much as Zach and I offer layouts, Sammy is the kind of artist, like, I think that page we scripted as a 9-panel grid where the grid was the bars of the cell. So that was there. And then Sammy is such a genius that Sammy's like the humblest genius in the world, where he just does this crazy page, like the one that's in the final version. And he's like, "I don't know, like, would you guys think this looks good?" And we're like, yeah, dude, like, it's pretty good.
That page is amazing.
Yeah. There's something in issue 4 he's done that is like, I can close my eyes and visualize it. It's so fucking crazy and wonderful. And he's very humble. He's just like, you know, I took that idea that you guys put on the page and I played around with it a little bit and I got this. And we're just like, oh, fucking K, man. Jeez, this is a fucking masterpiece. Good Lord. And then with Jason working with him too, you just get a level. I don't know. Those guys were born to work together and they are so perfectly in sync. And so, yeah, we're very lucky.
That's great.
You guys are coming to Undone by Blood off of the finale of Yondu over at Marvel. And as a little bit of like an exit interview, how do you guys feel about how Yondu concluded, what the working process on that story was like, especially as compared to launching a new indie title like this?
It's funny because we were working on Undone by Blood before Yondu, and it sort of influenced us to want to make Yondu a Western. Because yeah. we're already kind of doing one, like we've already done a lot of the research. What if we just sort of like change it around? And our editor was like, "What if it's in space?" And we were like, no, that didn't happen. It was always going to be in space. But it was just kind of this idea of like, what does a Western look like in the Marvel universe, you know? And I mean, the process working on that, like everything at Marvel, is just like, it's so fast. It's very different. You don't have time to be meticulous. We don't have time to like say this is what the layout's going to look like and stuff like that. So a lot of that is left up to the artist. And thankfully, John McCrae is so good that it came out the way we would have wanted it to anyway, I think is the easiest way to say it.
Yeah. And it also came out very quickly. It was one of our own only books at Marvel to like double ship. And so it started in the second week of November and concluded in the first week of February, which is You know, pretty quick for five issues to come out. So it kind of feels like we blinked and it's over. But it was, you know, working with John was an absolute blast because we did sometimes go like, you know what, this sequence, we imagine it looking like this, but like, what do you think? And he'd be like, how about this crazy two-page spread? And we'd be like, that is amazing. And he had he seemed to have a lot of fun in it. He oftentimes mm-hmm. we would, you know, workshop with him about like what was the tone of this scene, and then it would come back and it would just be layered with background jokes. And we put some of those in, but like with a Marvel script, you get maybe, you know, two or three extra sentences of leeway. Mm-hmm. So you have to be very sparing with those things. But John just picked up on that. And I think that, like, we share a very similar sense of humor, so it was really cool to... And then, like, you know, the other thing is, I think when we were originally talking about the book, we were like, well, let's just do a Hitman in the Marvel Universe. And the editor was like, yeah, that sounds great. What if we got John McCrae? And we were like, okay, that sounds good.
Nice.
Yeah.
Since these projects are kind of... formulating and being written obviously over different lengths of time, does it ever cross your mind to actively work to avoid similarities between your projects?
Oh yeah. Like we always want to like make sure that our work is sort of like different. Like we never want, obviously we want people to know it's like us and our brand, but we don't ever want people to be like, didn't they do this in the last thing?
Right.
Which is, I think we've done a pretty good job of avoiding that.
Yeah, so I mean, far. Like the, you know, a Western, what was the last creator-owned book before that? We retold Dante's Inferno. So can't get much different, more different than that. And I think like there is a conscious effort that we've made to pick our projects in a way that shows off different skill sets, but also stretches a different set of muscles, forces you to do a new type of research, and you can't like rest on your laurels in that way, right? You can't go like, well, I've already done all this, so I'll just shit out another Western, I guess.
God, that'd be awful.
Yeah.
Do you find yourselves trying to explore the same themes or narratives through different genres?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
We it's not a deliberate thing by any means, but every single book we've done together, at some point we've been like, God damn it, we're writing about memory again.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's just, that's always what it's come down to is I don't know, for some reason Zach and I just like keep going back to the idea of memory and how it like impacts the present.
Yeah, and it's pretty it's layered throughout Undone by Blood too, you know? And like, I think maybe the next thing we're about to work on is not having anything to do with memory for the first time ever, but I'm sure
you'll stumble across it.
I can already see how it's going to come into it, Zach. I'm sorry, man. And then at the other side of that is like, anytime we run into a problem in a script where like we sort of run into a wall, we're like, I think the answer is more body horror.
And it generally works.
Okay. Last but not least, and this is a callback to our previous interview with you, Lonnie, how do you think Yondu would fare in the world of Undone by Blood? And Zach, for reference, we asked him how he would fare in Black Stars Above, and he said, oh, he would die immediately.
I think he'd do well in Sweetheart. I think he'd make a good home.
Yeah. He'd be the captain of the football team.
Oh, foreshadowing. Our next segment, Off Topic Top Shelf, we're just going to ask you both, what's something you're into right now that's not comics related? It can be books, movies, could be scotch, could be vacations in the Caymans.
I wish.
Hiding your money in Swiss banks.
Zach, do you got anything?
I could rant about Death Stranding because I just...
Hell yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's get into it.
I won't do any spoilers or anything, but I just beat it the other day after spending probably 2 months with it, taking my sweet time with it, and it was like simultaneously one of the best gaming experiences and cinematic experiences I've ever had. And I want, like, some of it, I have many complaints, actually.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
Just in terms of writing, I think it sort of comes up pretty short. But there's a lot of really good performances in it. But man, there is some stilted fucking dialogue that I was having a real hard time with. At one point, someone hands someone something and says, "Here, I'm giving you a metaphor." And I nearly... Yeah,
that sounds awesome.
I nearly, like, shattered my controller. But, like, you know, hanging out for 3 hours with Nicholas Winding Refn in his, like, weird mountain home after his heart stops every 20 minutes... And you get to look at his fucking Blu-ray collection in his house. I was really into that.
Nice.
Yeah. But yeah, really, I don't know. Like, different type of game that felt meditative in its own way. And I really enjoyed how it prioritizes, like, cinematic beauty in its environments and sort of making you take your time. And the amount of times that you have a shitload of stuff on your back and you can't move very quickly and you have to walk down the side of a mountain. And then, like, a song comes on and just plays for a full 5 minutes as, like, snow is blowing in your face and you're, like, trying not to die. I don't know. I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And it's bold, you know. It's not perfect, but it's such a different type of gaming experience that, like, I don't know. It will stick with me for a very long time.
Yeah, I mean, I have not played many games that marry the themes to the gameplay that well, to the mechanics. Mm-hmm. So at least for that aspect, it'll definitely stick with me as well.
Yeah, sticks and ropes.
Nice. Anything new since we last spoke to you about, what was it, like 3 weeks ago we just talked to you?
I feel bad bringing it up because it's, like, so fucking nerdy and douchey at the same time. But I only bring it up because I have it open in front of me. I've been reading a lot of just a lot of poetry in general. I try to read poetry before I write every day, but specifically I've been rereading a lot of T.S. Eliot because I haven't read it since I was in university. I was rereading The Wasteland and The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock, and The Wasteland just, like, I liked it when I first read it, but reading it again 10 years later just kind of blew me away. Mm. It's such a beautiful piece of work that I don't think I fully appreciated before, but now I read it in every line. I'm like, oh my God. And there's actually a line in there that I didn't notice before, but it's Neil Gaiman fucking took it and used it for a Sandman advertisement and for it back in, like, the it was an advertisement in one of the Vertigo books, like, a while back.
Yeah.
And I love that.
That's interesting. Huh. Did he give him credit in the ad?
No.
Probably not.
No.
Oh, no.
And it's perfect for Sandman. The line is, I will show you pain in a fistful of dust, or I will show you fear in a fistful of dust, or something. And it's like, I mean, I believe that Neil Gaiman wrote that, and then I saw it was a T.S. Eliot line, and I was like, fuck you, Neil Gaiman. You're just copying shit like the rest of us.
So be honest with us. Did you get on the T.S. Eliot kick after seeing Cats?
Oh my God.
You know what? I actually, like, didn't even put that together, but that's probably, like, why he was in my brain. That's so weird. Like, now I, like, owe something to fucking Cats, and I hate that.
It brought you joy in a different way.
Oh man.
By extension.
That's crazy. Like, you figured out my brain before I did.
That's the magic of Cats, baby.
We're all going to find out in 20 years. It's still affecting us.
It's the cause of coronavirus.
Well, thank you guys so much for being on. If you want to check out Undead by Blood, you can find it in comic shops February 12th from Aftershock Comics. Thank you so much, guys.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having us.
Yeah, thank you so much.